And now a short civics lesson about school funding in Washington and what's next. The light is at the end of the tunnel for Washington legislators as far as public school funding goes and satisfying a mandate from the state Supreme Court to spend more money for schools. State Superintendent Chris Rakedahl says the court has signed off on the legislature's remedy that includes raising the state property tax next year.
I think the court said to the legislature, you got it done from the perspective of the court. You used the formulas that we said were basic education that the legislature wrote in 2009 and 2010. You did make sure that the state money is now going to cover those formulas instead of locally funded property taxes. But you're taking too long. The court was really clear to say, we had an expectation this would be done in 2018. Your full plan doesn't really kick in until 2019, so we need you to speed that up as much as you can. The court didn't ask for another $1 billion of new money. They said, you really got to pull something forward here to satisfy our timeline.
So they're still going to have to come up with $1 billion extra dollars. They're just sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and I think that's the big hard question. Because they closed this last little increment with state property tax, you really can't go faster on that. You can't impose that any quicker. There are mechanics to the local auditors and local assessors, you know, getting the mechanics of that in place. So there's discussion on whether or not the legislature will use some one-time fund balance. The revenue forecast growth continues to improve, so can they essentially assume a good economic fortunes going forward and spend some money sooner. So there's lots of people thinking about how to do this faster.
So that's where Washington legislators will start in January. And now we go back to the original question we had for Rakedahl. Where does all the money Washington spends for schools come from?
It comes from the state general fund. And so it is primarily sales tax, B&O tax, and property tax as the three big sources. But there isn't really a particular source specifically funding schools. What they solved, if you will, this last session, the last increment of what they needed is coming from a state property tax. But again, that's just an increment. We're spending roughly $13 billion a year on schools. And again, the vast bulk of that sales tax, B&O tax, and some state property.
Local money that people will pay. Has that percentage gone up in recent memory?
Yeah, that's a more complicated question, but yes, depending on where you are regionally, it used to hover at 20-24, sometimes in excess of 28% of local school budgets was coming from those local school levies. And that's when the court eventually stepped in and said, you know, you're paying for basics out of locally voted levies that may or may not pass. Therefore, we're really not guaranteeing each student a basic education.
So what about special education? How's that paid for?
It is supposed to be a basic education provision, so it's supposed to come from the state. It's a little different in that, unlike a general education student, a special education student is entitled to the basic ed amount plus an additional 93% of the basic education amount on average, and that's what's important. It's not an entitlement to an individual student. But in all of the students who are qualifying for special education in the Spokane School District, for example, each of those student FTEs, each of those full-time equivalent students, would be getting an additional 93% on top of basic education. Again, should be provided by the state.
With the legislature kicking in extra money, with the Supreme Court weighing in on it, are you satisfied that finally basic education is getting the amount of funding that it deserves in Washington?
Couple thoughts on that. I think the really basic formulas are getting addressed now by the state. It's a really positive thing. It was bipartisan. It was hard work. I give them all the credit in the world for just an enormous leap over the next 4 years and how much they're going to spend to make sure the state covers it. I continue to believe that those formulas, while they are the current definition of basic education, were drafted quite a while ago, and some of them, in my opinion, are not current. So even if you believe enough money is now provided for special education based on the old formulas, I would suggest to you that that is not the future of special education. These students are going to need a lot more intensive support. And so did they solve the current definition of basic? Yes, I think they did. Is it the one we would want if we were designing the system tomorrow? Absolutely not. in the same way that in the 1960s, the court would have said, oh, you got to fund everybody through an eighth grade education. That was basic education at the time. And we now know that's laughable. I mean, you can imagine what would happen if we only educated our kids through the eighth grade. So basic education evolves through time. And I think the legislature did a good job kind of resnapping the line based on where they are today. But we're trying to push on and have a much bigger conversation about what that system should look like tomorrow, including enhancements for special ed, enhancements for career and technical education that go beyond what they just did.
Given that the legislature spent so much time talking about education over the last 4 years, do you think there's much appetite for getting into something like that?
It's a really fair question. I do think there's some fatigue, and it's not a matter of legislators not caring deeply about public education. I think some of them on both sides of the aisle would say, there are also other things we want to pay attention to and put energy into, and I feel like in some ways they believe some of that's kind of been in the shadows. It's understandable, but again, your paramount duty is basic ed in this state. What we're trying to say to them is, well, let's have a very different conversation about what we get from education in the future. So it's not a routine conversation about formulas. But what outcomes do you want? Are you satisfied with 80% graduation rates? Because we think we should be number one in the country. So we think we got to push up into the mid to high 90s to be realistic for our economy. And as I've been pretty public about, I think that means big transformation for our schools. Going to essentially a year-round school model, adding additional instructional hours, thinking very differently about the 11th and 12th grades so that kids can graduate ready for industry. We're excited to have a bigger conversation, so there might be some McCleary fatigue, but I'm confident there isn't a fatigue about what high-quality public schools look like.
Well, it sounds to me like those types of conversations need to be had with the public before you can get to the legislature. What are you hearing from the schools who report to you?
Well, they're in this really, difficult time where they're trying to understand all the changes that just came their way. So they are really receptive to transformation. They see a bigger vision. They know they've got to improve on graduate rates. They know they've got to do better work on students in poverty and second language learners and communities of color. So they see the gaps. I think what they would say is, we definitely want to think about that. We want to begin to plan for that, but we really got to understand what just happened to us. We just got our local levies reduced. The state's going to backfill all or most of it. Some districts ended up better than others. So there's a little bit of reeling right now. They're thinking, wow, that's a lot of change you're pushing forward when we don't fully understand what just happened. We have the mental capacity to do both right now.
So I want to be clear, does this mean that local school levies go away, or are they smaller, or are they, what's the future for those?
Smaller, certainly in the short run they're smaller. They can no longer be used to fund basic ed, but they can still be used for enrichment. So I always think of sort of the classic school district who has a regular 180-day school year, 1,000 instructional hours, but then they say, you know what, we've got kids in programs, they want to go longer into the summer, or some kids need additional support, or we have activities that aren't basic ed, but we really want to invest in them. Maybe it's science clubs or robotics or something. That's still going to come from locally voted on enrichment levies. And those have limits. The legislature just put some new limits on them. I actually think it's a little silly to restrict them so aggressively if they no longer are covering basic ed and it's completely enrichment and it's a vote of the people that puts them in place. I'm advocating that we get a little more flexibility for our districts on these local levies.
So how do you think rural school districts as a whole are going to be affected by this? Do you think it's going to allow them to add things that they're not able to afford right now?
You know, it's really a mixed bag, and here's why. The legislature changed the way we compensate our teachers in this new finance system. So there are rural districts who do quite a bit better because they were not able to raise a lot of local levy money. They don't have the tax base. It would have just been absolutely prohibitive to have such a high tax rate in order to fund teachers at the rate that other districts pay. So some of them get additional help from the state now to pay a more competitive salary for their teachers. So their funding system got a little better. There are other rural districts, though, who were very veteran staffs. In other words, they had very experienced teachers and administrators and classified employees. And now that the state only gives everybody an average amount per employee, instead of actually funding the real cost of who they hire, you will see some rural districts who say, oh, man, it's nice that the state stepped up, but I lost some local levy authority, and the state no longer pays me for my really experienced staffers. And so even in parts of rural Washington, some of them are saying, this system didn't work out quite as well as I hoped it would. So it's kind of a mixed bag in rural Washington.
Okay, Chris, I think that's good for me. Was there anything that I didn't ask you about that you wanted to talk about or bring up?
Well, I think the other question that's pretty consistent we hear is, what about capital budget? If the legislature is investing more in students and they're lowering class sizes and we're expecting more career and technical education, do we have the facilities to even do that? And it's a really good question because the court affirmed that that is not necessarily basic education. It's not an obligation of the state. And yet you think, oh my gosh, if the state doesn't pay for that and I'm in a rural community, how in the world can I raise enough resources to build a whole new building or even a classroom sometimes? So we have matching funds here in my office, and the legislature is poised to increase them if they can pass a capital budget. And we're going to push really hard over the next couple years to increase that very specifically so that communities with low tax bases, very rural agricultural communities, can still have a shot at high-quality facilities, particularly that we've evolved in science and math and engineering. They need really good space there, too, and it's been tough for them. So the capital space is the other parallel conversation to all the changes in the operating budgets.
Chris Rakedahl is Washington State School Superintendent. School funding is not just a timely issue in Washington. In the next few weeks, we'll learn more about a proposed change for school funding in Idaho.